Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd, 2003. In the fireside room this morning, John Lauber is continuing his presentation on historic preservation at Holden, stewardship of the built environment. Today's topic is entitled Searching for Significance, an introduction to the National Register of Historic Places. This is presentation LAJ 2003-2. Let's listen in.
Welcome to session two on historic preservation. Today I thought we'd talk a little bit about the National Register of Historic Places. I mentioned this yesterday as one of the things that came out of that Historic Preservation Act of 1966. It was sort of the main provision of that legal or legislative action. I want to remind you again that you are currently housed and living in a property that has been determined eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. But what I thought we'd do today is talk a little bit about how that determination was made, some of the things that we think about when we're trying to figure out what is historic. Is it just, you know, is it just old? Or what is it that makes something historic? Is there more to it than just age? So, as you can see here, it's an introduction to the National Register. When we deal with cultural resources, remember that term, cultural resources. We start with a universe that's not the natural environment, but the built environment. And there's all kinds of stuff in it. As you can see, this is a 1940 view of the city of Duluth, Minnesota, the Minnesota seacoast on Lake Superior. And you can see in this shot, there's a lot of stuff out there. Off to the right's kind of a blank area, not built up a whole lot, but there's stuff out there. There's a big structure in the middle of the picture, a few low-flying skyscrapers and some other stuff. So that's kind of where we start. And out of all that stuff, we have to figure out a way, by mandate, as a cultural resource person, our charge is to go look at all this stuff, evaluate it, and figure out what's important. Well, the National Register, just to go back one step, is an official list of properties that are deemed worthy of preservation. I'm just reading the title here, as you can see. So what our charge is to figure out what properties are worthy of preservation. We start by defining some types of things. When you think of the National Register, when most of us think of the National Register, I think we're probably thinking most often of the first thing here, buildings. We all know some buildings that are historic that are on the National Register, but we also have other kinds of things, and I'm going to show you some examples here in a minute. Districts, various sorts, structures, this gets a little bit more mysterious, objects, even more mysterious, and sites, really mysterious. So we've got a sort of continuum of types of things. We may or may not understand what all these mean. Well, here's a building. We all know what a building is. Buildings can be listed on the National Register. This is the Fauché Tower in Minneapolis. It was for many years the one and only skyscraper in Minneapolis, and it has an interesting story behind it. It was built in 1929, the early part of 1929, by a guy named Robert Fauché, who was kind of a con artist, but he did very well at that. He made a lot of money, and he installed himself in the top of this building in a very, well, he built for himself a very elaborately appointed office. But between the time that office was finished and the time he was going to move in, October 1929 happened, and Wilbur Fauché lost every dime he had, ended up in jail for some of his activities, and never got to sit in his office chair ever. But this is a designed by a locally prominent architectural firm, which is still in business today, and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places for Minnesota.
Who was the architect?
Well, I knew you were going to ask this. It's Magna Tussler, which you probably never heard of. The company today is known as Setter, Leach, and Lindstrom. Districts are also eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. This is the city of Crookston, the downtown commercial district in Crookston, Minnesota, the northwest corner, a railroad town, as it looked in 1915. A pretty nice town, and you can see what they used for transportation in those days. Here's what it looks like recently. Still a fairly intact downtown area. It was the commercial heart of that community and is, as such, is listed on the National Register as a historic district. Here's that structure that we spotted way back at the beginning. This is, to Minnesotans, this is an icon. Everybody knows what this is. This is the aerial lift bridge in Duluth, Minnesota. It allows you to get out onto that blank space, that spit of land that went out into Lake Superior Park Point. It also allows ships to come in and out. This is a bridge that was originally built in about 1906. And it was interesting at that time because instead of having a lift span, that center span going up and down, it had a little tramway, a little car that you would get into, a gondola that would go across the water. It would just take people and people in bicycles or people and a dog. And in the 20s, there were enough cars going out onto Park Point that bridge was reconstructed by a well-known engineer, C.A.P. Turner from Minnesota, who reconfigured it as a lift span that would accommodate automobiles. So this is considered a structure. It's not a building and it's not a district. It's a structure. It's a construction of some sort. It's listed on the National Register as an engineering marvel. This is an object. This again is familiar to anybody. Why, some of you might
see. Oh yes.
This is the famed statue of Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox, constructed in Bemidji by the Chamber of Commerce in 1937. 1937 marked the beginning of an active effort in northern Minnesota, the Lakes Country, to do economic development through tourism. And the Chamber of Commerce got this idea, well, we're up here in the north, there's lots of trees around, let's claim to be the home of Paul Bunyan. So first, they had a bunch of local guys who got together and with chicken wire and wood, built that statue of Paul Bunyan. And then to kind of get the word out to surrounding communities, they took a Model T chassis, took the body off, and with more chicken wire and wood, built Babe and drove Babe around to all the surrounding communities. So Babe was on wheels for the first 2 years of her life. And that was a way to sort of rustle up the tourism business. So Paul Bunyan and Babe are on the National Register for Minnesota. This is a local site, and one that Greg Griffith, sitting in the corner over here, and I walked up to last night. This is a cabin at Honeymoon Heights, or the remnants of a cabin at Honeymoon Heights. So another type of thing we're looking at is a site. This was a building. It actually could be part of a district, I suppose, because there were other buildings around there. But right now, it's the ruin of a building. What a site generally does is give us information about something that used to be there. So a lot of times, sites have to do with archaeology.
So where is this?
This is at Honeymoon Heights. It's up the side of the mountain. There's a little orange blaze on the side above the main tailings piles. If you look way up there, it was an early settlement that predated the Holden Mine, where prospectors lived. And when the mine opened, some of the families went up there and rehabbed some of the old cabins and lived up there sort of as a satellite community to the main Holden mining community.
Is there a sign or a plaque or anything?
If you walk up the road past the Portal Museum and kind of go around to the top of the tailings, there's a little tiny sign that points you to Honeymoon Heights, and you can walk a steep road up. It's not a bad hike. It would take us an hour and a half last night, Greg. Mm-hmm. And you'll go past this cabin and a bunch of other remnants of buildings that were there. And there's a 1929 Model A's up there as well, the remnants. So this is a site. Just to clarify one thing, when we're talking about the National Register, we assume that history begins at 50, so I would assume that many of us in this room are historic.
Yes.
Okay. That's sort of an arbitrary cutoff, but there's a reason for it. And I was talking to Anne before we started. I think all of us can think of some building or place that we liked that disappeared at some point. And a lot of times the reason the place disappeared is that at a certain point in history, people thought, well, that's old and ugly, and we're going to get rid of it because it's not useful, it's not pretty. Sometimes you need, and then in retrospect, people wish that it hadn't been taken down. That 50-year cutoff gives you some perspective. It lets you sort of digest the news before you tear something down or get rid of it. But it gives you a half century of perspective so that you can evaluate what really is important in the long run. So generally, we start our assumptions about the National Register saying it's got to be at least 50 years old. There are several levels of significance, and this is one of the big changes that happened with that Historic Preservation Act of 1966, is that the purview of what historic preservation was all about was magnified. It used to be that the primary focus was on sites that were the whole country thought were important. But in 1966, that was expanded so that not only nationally important sites, but also sites that are important to states or to local communities could be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Here's an example. We looked at this yesterday. It's Independence Hall in Philadelphia. I think we'd all agree this is a site that has significance to the whole country. It's designated as a historic site. This is one that probably most of you wouldn't immediately see as a National Register site. This is the Clark's Grove Cooperative Creamery in South Central Minnesota. It was the first, it was built by the first creamery association, creamery co-op in Minnesota. And I don't know how many of you know this, but at one time in Minnesota, there were 673 farmers cooperative creameries, which meant that almost every town in Minnesota, there are 900 incorporated towns in Minnesota, almost every town had a co-op creamery. And that sort of cooperative movement got its start here in Clark's Grove. So this represents a really important event to Minnesota history. This is a site, a building that represents local importance. It's the Damon Round Barn in Goodhue County, just overlooking the Mississippi River near Red Wing, Minnesota. You know, it's not a nationally important site. It's not the best piece of farm architecture in the country. But it's an extraordinarily well-constructed, well-conceived, and well-preserved example of a round barn. This was built in 1914. And within the last year, it has been rehabbed. It's no longer serving cattle and horses. It's now serving tourists as a part of a B&B operation. The hay floor has been turned into a dance hall, and they have barn dances and weddings and all kinds of stuff in this building. But it's listed on the National Register. And in Minnesota, again, if you drive down the River Road, the Great River Road, Highway 61, out of the Twin Cities, this is a familiar landmark to Minnesotans. But it's primarily local importance. I'll read the caption to you because I don't know if you can see it. But I suppose there's quite a story behind all this. Well, that's kind of the idea behind the National Register. We're trying to pick out things that have some kind of a story behind them, but it's not always obvious. Let me show you a couple of examples here. This blurry photo is, anybody know what this is? Greg.
Franklin Wright's home and studio in Oak Park.
Oak Park, Illinois. This was the place where Frank Lloyd Wright, I think all of you probably know who that is, did his earliest work and sort of developed his early prairie style buildings. It was, as the name connotes, his home and studio. So he lived here and he did his work here as well. This is currently owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It's a beautiful restoration, a nationally prominent site. If you look at it, you know there's something interesting about this place just by looking at the nature of the buildings. And if if you go a little further and do some research, it's pretty obvious that this is a historic site. Now let me show you another place. Anybody know what this is? Okay, well this is Universal Laboratories in Dassel, Minnesota, which doesn't tell you very much. But during World War II, this was a place where ergot was processed for the war effort. Anybody know what ergot is? Ann, you have a farm background.
It's something of a cow or something.
No, ergot is a disease of rye, which is a grain.
Oh, just rye.
It's a disease of this rye grain. And what it is two things. It's a hallucinogen,
ooh,
like LSD, but it's also a coagulant. So for the war effort, it was important to find medications that would help stop bleeding. And so in the 40s, this place was built, and the way it worked was they would store the ergot, they would store rye grain in this building and process it in the part with the windows, store it in the other part. And they would have people in this community, this small community, come in daily and get a bag of rye, and they would go home to their kitchen tables, and they would sit down and they would sort the grains. And they'd pick out the diseased grains, and then they'd come back to Universal Laboratories and start the processing to turn this into this anticoagulant for the war effort. So this actually contributed to the national war effort during World War II. Very nondescript building, but also has great local significance because almost every family in Dassel during World War II was sitting at the kitchen table sorting grains of rye to come up with this medication. When we talk about the National Register, we're not just sort of shooting in the dark or trying to, you know, guess at what might be historic. When we're trying to come up with what that story is, and we're given some guidance. We're given a lot of guidance, actually. I'm showing you an example of the A National Register bulletin. There are, I think, close to 40 of them now. But the basics are very simple. There are four established criteria that you try to pin your history to or your significance to. And they have to do with important events, important people, architecture or engineering, and information. So those are the basics, and I'm going to show you some examples of each type. The first criterion, association with significant patterns of events. Anybody guess what this might be?
It's like a prison.
Well, for certain types of creatures it might have been. This was
Indian school? That's running out of roots? It's not the Kentucky Derby.
No, this is in Minnesota. It's in Manoman, Minnesota. It's the Manoman County Fairgrounds. So an important annual event was the Manoman County Fair. That's part of that pattern of events. But also, this is a structure that was built in 1938 as a WPA project. And so that's sort of a dual level of association with significant events. First of all, this county fair that was a regionally important event each year. And also, as an example of a WPA project that was, you know, represented a movement that was nationwide in the 30s. So this is listed on the register as for its association with important events. Anybody know who this is? I'll give you a hint. It's somebody who's a famous writer from Minnesota.
Greg,
got it. This is F. Scott Fitzgerald, who did a lot of his work in Minnesota. There he is at work at his desk, presumably, possibly in this building. This is the F. Scott Fitzgerald Row House on Summit Avenue in St. Paul. It's a Romanesque building, which was his dwelling place for many years and a place where he did a lot of his writing. It's actually listed on the register and is a National Historic Landmark as well. I think when we think of the National Register, as I said earlier, most of us think of sort of architecturally interesting or important buildings. This is the Purcell Cutts House, in Minneapolis. It's owned by the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. It's interpreted as a house museum. It's an example, a really good example of the work of two Prairie School architects from Minnesota, Purcell and Elmsley. And it was actually the home for the mother-in-law of one of those architects. It's a beautiful Prairie School building. The interior is fabulous, and I wish I had some pictures to show you. But it's listed on the register because it is a great example of Prairie School architecture.
To be listed on the register, it doesn't mean the interior is open to the public. It just refers to the exterior.
Generally, there are some exceptions, but that's what we'll get to in the handout a little bit.
Are most of these open for touring?
Most of them are not. This is a designation process. So in most cases, these are privately owned properties. And you know, unless you want to open the door to somebody, you don't have to. This is another Criterion C property. This is known to everybody in Minneapolis as the Nordicware Tower. Nordicware is a company that makes aluminum bundt pans. But actually, this is another National Historic Landmark, more appropriately known as the P.V. Haglund Experimental Concrete Elevator. It is the first example of a reinforced concrete slip cast grain elevator built in 1906 through a collaboration between the Pillsbury family and a local engineer named Charles Haglund. Most of us have seen grain elevators that consist of a whole bunch of these sort of attached together. This was the prototype, and it was a really revolutionary approach to grain elevator construction, both in terms of the construction process itself. They built a round form that was maybe 6 or 8 feet high, poured concrete into it, and then slid it up the side of the building. It was also a very early use of reinforced concrete. 1906 was pretty early to be using Portland cement concrete. So that is, it's not tremendously aesthetically appealing, but it has great engineering significance. This is a site that we, on the right is the site, that meets criterion D, which is the ability to yield data or information about something. What's there today is what you see on the right. That thing, that stuff on the right used to be the stuff on the left, which is the USS Essex, a sailing ship built for the US Navy on the East Coast in the 1870s. Decommissioned, sort of refitted a bunch of times, ended up on the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes, and eventually ended up in Duluth. At the end of its useful life, it was pulled up onto the shore on Sand Point, or Park Point, that spit of land again that we saw in that first photograph, and burned. And what's left is what you see on the right. It's an archaeological site that has, we think, the ability to tell us something about the construction of U.S. Navy vessels sort of at the end of the sailing ship era. Another thing we look at for the register is integrity. What that means is not honesty so much, or you know, good moral character, but does that property, whatever it is, still retain the features that it had when it was initially constructed? This is a lookout, Mount Tom Lookout, in one of Minnesota's state parks, built at the top of a high hill. There are some hills in Minnesota. And the idea was that you could come up, you could hike up to the top of this hill, and you could rest by sitting on one of those buttresses or on that low ledge between the buttresses and sit in the shade and kind of collect your wits and get your breath back, and then hike back down. Well, that's what it looked like when it was built during the 1930s by the Civilian Conservation Corps. And I'm going to show you what the local Lions Club did after the trees around that place grew up so that you couldn't see very far anymore. Well-intentioned, good fundraisers, they did this to it. They raised it up 10 feet so you could get the view. Well, that was great, but the problem is it doesn't look anything like what it looked like initially. It's lost its integrity. It's no longer what it was. And so this is one of the properties. We have a very fussy National Register historian in Minnesota who is very diligent about taking things off the register if they lose integrity, and this is one of our removals. I've given you some quick overview of what the basic criteria are that we use to evaluate properties, but there are exceptions to all those rules, and I'm going to quickly run through some of those. We generally don't list religious properties on the National Register, and there are a couple reasons for that. One is that it's sort of a duh that a church or a synagogue or a mosque is going to be an important place because it's a focal point of everybody's life. So it doesn't necessarily make that, it's a given that a church is going to be an important place. There's also some issues with separation of church and state. This is a federal program, and they try to be careful about that. So generally, religious properties are not listed on the National Register. This is my church in Minneapolis, which has been architecturally trashed. If you look on the right, you can see the 1960s edition. There are exceptions to this, however. There are a number of very fine examples of church architecture that are listed for architectural significance. There are rural churches that are listed because they were the gathering point for a rural community or a manifestation of an immigrant population, for example, a Norwegian church in Minnesota where people came for years and were able to worship in Norwegian and promulgate their ethnic origins. But generally, religious properties are accepted from the National Register. Properties that have been moved are not only not listed on the National Register, if a property is listed and is subsequently moved, it is removed from the National Register. If you think about the name, the National Register of Historic places. Well, if you have a place and you remove a piece of it, it's still the place still stays where it started. So if you take one chunk of it off, it's not a place, it's a thing. So moved properties are not listed on the National Register. Birthplaces are generally not listed. There are exceptions to all this. Are generally not listed on the National Register. And the reason is quite simple. Most people aren't famous when they're born. They usually get famous later on. Usually they do their most important work sometime after birth. I think we're entering an era when that could change. We've got, you know, all this talk of cloning and so forth. At some point, there's going to be somebody who's significant because they were born. But at this point, birthplaces are generally accepted. This is the birthplace of Mamie Dowd Eisenhower, Ike's spouse, who was born in Boone, Iowa, and a local historical society has restored her house and is running it as a house museum. Cemeteries are generally not listed on the National Register, and it's kind of the flip side of the birthplace thing. Most people are famous before they die. So you do your useful work during those intervening years. And cemeteries, again, are, you know, resting places for people who maybe were famous. They are also protected by a lot of other mechanisms. So they don't need the protection afforded by the National Register. There are a lot of exceptions to this, however, because many cemeteries also reflect landscape architecture or have other artistic significance, and so there are some that are listed on the National Register.
Which one is this?
This is Lakewood Cemetery in Minneapolis. Okay. Commemorative sites are not listed on the National Register. Again, if you think about it, this is a bathtub Madonna. A commemorative site, commemorating something. But monuments, memorials, all those sorts of things, by the very virtue of their existence, they're already sort of marking something, and so they're generally accepted from the National Register. There are exceptions to all these. Things that are under 50 years old are generally not listed on the National Register. The caption says, it's soon to be listed in the National Register of Historic Military Holes in the Ground. I'm going to show you an exception to this that I got to work on a few years ago. There's the missile silo wide open. There's the missile silo outside Badlands National Park. there's me with my stomach sticking out, sitting standing in front of it about two summers ago. This is a site that I worked on. It's currently being, it's been acquired by the National Park Service as the last example of the early Minuteman missile installations from the Cold War era. It was finished in 1962 as part of the SALT treaties. The Air Force agreed to blow up most of these sites. There were initially 1,000 of them. There's now one of the early era Minuteman sites left, and it will be interpreted as a museum. This has now been named a National Historic Landmark as an example of Cold War era military strategy. And to really strike fear into your hearts, there I am at the controls. Reconstructed properties are generally not listed on the National Register. This is the Governor's Palace at Williamsburg, which I imagine is listed on the National Register. I didn't look it up. But generally, if you build a fake of something, it's not the real thing and therefore doesn't have any historic significance. This place may have attained significance as an example of an early preservation effort, so it has a significance on another level. But generally, reconstructed or fake properties are not listed. We talked just very briefly about the listing process. It begins with a lot of research and writing and thinking. We've gone through those criteria very quickly. If you want to list a property on the National Register, the first thing you need to do is research the history of that place and document its current condition and appearance and how that might be different or how it might be the same as the way it looked initially, because that's where we start figuring out what the integrity of that place is. Try to figure out what it was initially and what it is now, and then you try to do you do a history and a statement of significance that ties the history of that property to some of those criteria, one or more of those criteria we talked about. So you do extensive documentation, and then you take that to your State Historic Preservation Office. Every State Historic Preservation Office has a National Register historian on the staff. Their job is to evaluate that documentation, ask some questions if need be, help you tweak it, help you refine the argument if you're trying to tie it to a criterion, and then make a call at some point. And if the call is that we think this has significance, then that documentation is passed along to another level, as a review board made up of volunteers from around the state who, again, take a look at your documentation, ask you some questions, tweak it if need be, and then vote. And if they vote to that you've made a good case for this place, they send it on to the person in the National Park Service who has the best job title of anybody I ever heard of, which is Keeper of the National Register of Historic mm-hmm. Places. You have this vision of somebody with a giant key on the chamber. <Yeah. laughs> and if the keeper concurs with the SHPO and with the State Review Board, then your property is listed on the National Register. So then what? What does that mean? Well, here's one thing it could mean. You get a plaque. If you live in a good place and the state or the local community you live in is flush, they'll give you a plaque. This is a plaque unveiling at the Sinclair Lewis Boyhood Home in Sauk Center, Minnesota. This photograph was taken in 1968. But generally, that's about all you get. The National Register listing is primarily an honorary listing. And I want to talk a little bit more about that using the handout that I gave you. So I think that's the end of the slides. And first of all, let me ask if you have any questions.
Is it true that they don't pay any taxes, any state taxes?
No, there are some states that offer tax incentives of various sorts if you do work on a National Register property. It varies greatly from state to state.
Yeah, I think in Oregon it's that way.
But generally, at best, you would get a tax break of some sort.
How many are listed on it so far?
I don't know. Do you know, Greg, nationwide?
I have seen numbers in terms of properties and structures, thousands and thousands.
I know that in Minnesota we have about 1,500 listings, which represents about 6,000 individual things. And the reason that is that we have districts that contain more than one property. So, you know, you think of the universe of buildings in a given state, that's a pretty small percentage.
Heavens, it's good we're not living in Europe. I'm doing this.
But some of the one of the questions about taxes, so forth, that's the kind of thing we hear very often in our office. Once you get listed on the National Register, what does it actually mean? Let's just walk through this a little bit, and I'll just read the questions. I hate to do this way, but it's fairly efficient. What does it mean to me to have my property listed on the National Register? Well, not much. It means that your property has been documented and evaluated according to federal standards, and listed because it's significant in American history or any of the criteria we've outlined here. When my property is listed, is it preserved forever? The answer is no. It's up to you. It's up to whoever owns it. You get recognized. Your community may look at the property differently, but basically, listing doesn't confer any particular responsibility on you if you're using your own money and time to deal with it. Does listing on the National Register protect my property during federal or state projects? Yes. That's the primary protection. If you remember yesterday, I talked about the federal bulldozer, the sort of impetus for creation of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, which was that the feds had been going through and sort of willy-nilly taking things out that were important. That's the primary protection that's afforded by the National Register. It protects a historic property from the activities of the federal government. At Holden, we're in an interesting situation because Holden uses its own money to deal with the buildings here, but in order for this place to exist, Holden has to, every 15 years or so, apply for and receive a special use permit from the USDA Forest Service. And because there's a federal involvement that is a pivot point for Holden's very existence, Holden has some responsibilities for how it deals with the buildings here. So any federal involvement generally kicks in some protection for the resource. Is additional maintenance required once a property is listed on the National Register? No. You can let it fall into a heap if you're using your own money to do that. You asked Jen if property had to be open to the public. The answer is no. Are there covenants put on a deed when a property is listed on the National Register? No. Can I request to have my property removed from the National Register? You can request it, but your request will be refused. If it's historic, it's historic. And you're wishing that it wasn't doesn't make it not so. You can, however, as a property owner, refuse to have it listed in the first place. Again, the protection conferred by its eligibility is there. The Fed still can't mess with it without going through this review process, but you don't have to let it be listed. Can I demolish my property if it's listed on the National Register? The answer is yes. Under some circumstances, in Minnesota, for example, if you have to get a building permit for a demolition, there will have to be an environmental review done, and the state may require some documentation before your property can be torn down, but generally you can do what you want with it. Can my property be sold or given to heirs? Yes. Are my property taxes reduced? Not unless you live in a progressive state that has state tax incentives. Can I get a tax credit if I fix up my property? We'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow, but there is a federal rehabilitation tax credit program and some state equivalents that generally are tied to commercial properties, and in some cases you can qualify for a tax credit if you do work on your property. Am I automatically entitled to grants? I speak from personal experience when I say that most of the phone calls I get start with, I heard about the money that's available for fixing up National Register properties, and I always have to wonder what it was they were reading. They're generally, it's very little money available to help with it. Sometimes there is, but not often. Low-interest loans or mortgages, likewise, not usually. Sometimes a local historic district will have a revolving loan fund or something like that, but that's kind of done at the local level. Does having a property in a community that's listed on the register require creation of a local ordinance or a local heritage preservation commission? This varies somewhat from state to state. In Wisconsin, if there is a property on the national register, state law states that there should be a local ordinance passed to protect that, but the implementation of that law is very sluggish. If my property is listed on the register, are there provisions in building codes which affect it? There can be, but what it basically is that most building codes allow for flexible interpretation of code requirements to allow you to retain important features of historic buildings. So you can't get away with murder, but you might be able to negotiate with your building official. Does the American with Disabilities Act affect National Register properties? No more so than any other property. So that's a quick list. Are there other things you'd like to know about the National Register?
Yeah. What's happening with Paul Bunyan and the Blue Ox?
They're preserved in pristine condition and painted regularly. And
well, I understand South Dakota was going to go out and buy them.
Well, there's
and the governor was up there interfering.
That's a different Paul Bunyan, however.
Was it?
Minnesota has a whole bunch of them. You saw the Bemidji Paul Bunyan, and that was the Brainerd Paul Bunyan that's up for grabs.
Yeah, that's
it's true also that you can't really make any big changes on a building to change the looks at all.
If you're using your own money and your own time, you can pretty much do whatever you want. Unless there is if you have a local heritage preservation commission that's locally designated it, yes. But the National Register in and of itself, unless there's federal involvement, it's yours to deal with how you see fit.
So there's really no downside to being listed as far as upkeep?
Well, you're talking to somebody with a strong bias, but I would say no.
I thought there was a strong downside. We have
everybody thinks there's a strong downside, but I
well, if you change the integrity of the building, wouldn't they take you off of the
they sure.
Yeah. So you're better off to leave it alone except for the inside?
But if they might take you off the list, but then
so what?
You apparently would have made a decision that wasn't important.
Okay.
Yet.
All right.
Pause.
John, on the I think if you have a property like Holden, which is sitting on public land, federal land, yes, it as a private landowner like Holden is, there are more restrictions on them, in terms of what they can do to their buildings and how they do it, than it would be, if it was your private house on your private property. So
but
that's,
those restrictions are in place anyway because we're already on federal land here or not?
They are, but see, that's perception is that oftentimes people have summer homes, places that are on public land. Yes, there is pretty tight control over what people can and can't do to their own property. But, I think that's where that perception of, once it's on the register, you can't touch it or you can't do things to it. Or I think some of it comes from that.
I guess there is that sort of kind of misconception. I sort of assume that maybe, if your windows were rotten, you couldn't put in vinyl windows or you couldn't put in some newer style window. You had to go back to wood. But you can.
You could do, what's Holden can't necessarily go in and just put in vinyl windows.
But it's because of that federal connection.
It's the federal connection that oftentimes makes, or the perception that it makes it difficult to do anything different.
Or with like say, with roofing products.
Right.
If you re-roof the chalets, will they have to be re-roofed with cedar, or will they already have to be re-roofed with cedar?
Well, it's negotiable.
I mean, because obviously that's a fire hazard in this kind of, aesthetically it's beautiful, but it's certainly a fire hazard.
Well, my job as a forest archaeologist is to work with people like Greg Griffith, who's with the State Historic Preservation Office, to come up and work with Holden, to come up with compatible materials or some material that takes that into consideration. And there's a volume of materials out there now, different materials for roofing. But my job is basically to help Holden, help Greg, Christopher Gilje and his group come up with compatible or in-kind replacements that will protect the buildings, retain their historic character, and work, protect them against fire. But
so it can be, so it's essentially the way you're talking, it's kind of a win-win.
Well, hopefully.
It's a flexible, it's a flexible kind of process. And I should also say that it's not our decision as well. It's really up to the federal agency that's involved and the property owner. And what we're doing is we're just trying to protect that historic character and the integrity that John referenced, that there's a value there. There's a value of those kinds of materials that is worthy of protection and recognition. But recognize the fact that there are those kind of extraneous kinds of issues, such as fire, maintenance. We work with people to try to, have a win-win, try to get to close to win-win as possible.
Yeah. Let me go back. I don't know if everybody heard who these folks are, but you're lucky this week. We have a huge representation of the historic preservation brain power from the entire country here all at once.
That's no exaggeration.
Lois Gadd is a USDA Forest Service forest archaeologist who is responsible for helping Holden deal with its status as a cultural resource. Is that a fair assessment? And Greg Griffith is the Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer for the state of Washington. So this is part of the team that's working with Holden to try to figure out how to be good stewards of this place in the years to come. And part of why I'm up here is to talk to you folks about historic preservation, but also we've gotten our heads together the last couple days to try to begin working on a plan that will lay out in fairly concise fashion how Holden might want to proceed with accommodating its programmatic needs and still retaining its character as a cultural resource. So you got three people to ask questions.
Tell us now about the buildings here. Were these all buildings that were used during the mining era, or have they been built since, or what?
Pretty much everything in the town site proper was here during the mining period. I'm trying to think if there's any. I don't think there are any.
Wood storage building over here.
There's one behind Chalet 1, a wood storage crib. Up on the tailings, there are a couple garage buildings that were later additions. There have been some other changes there. The addition on the back of Koinonia was added in the early 80s. There have been some changes, but basically what's here is what was here. And most of the changes have been to components of the buildings.
Rather inside.
Largely
inside. I mean, this building alone. This was a dormitory.
Yeah, this had small rooms with a center hall.
So most of the changes, when you look at the outsides of the buildings here, most of them are pretty much original. With the additions now, some handicap ramps, and school has been added on to. This building has an addition. But on the exteriors, they're pretty much like they were before, with the exception of some of them with the roofs. Inside, if you go inside the chalets, the first floors are pretty much original, but the second floors have all been remodeled and redone. So there have been a number of interior changes as well.
So changing the interiors doesn't necessarily affect the historical.
It can. It certainly can, because there are elements inside that are just as important as the outside. And believe me, if you go into the old chalets from the 30s, they retain those characteristics of the 30s that give them a really interesting character. And there are certainly elements inside all these buildings that are historic that contribute to their significance. The bowling alley, if you've been over in there, that village center is probably one of the most original buildings that has not changed significantly since the 1930s.
It hasn't been open since we've been here.
Yeah.
We'd like to get it.
Tonight you can bowl.
Will there be a lesson?
Who's the pencil?
So there's been kind of a misconception too that generally, you deal with the outsides, the exteriors, and part of that's a privacy issue. These are private homes and privately owned places, and you don't like to go inside. But for what I do in the Forest Service, even if it's a private home, even if it's a federal building, there are many elements inside that contribute to its significance. So interior and exterior, we have to consider the whole. And oftentimes, the whole community like this, maybe you're going to get some buildings that contribute to the to the district's importance and some that don't. So our job is to go around and identify those and protect the things that do contribute.
So say the building we're in, where it's obviously been quite a bit remodeled in this, does that affect
yes.
the listing of this building? Would the changes that have been done here in itself already probably negate this as being a historical building?
Well, there's still mostly in this building, there's still a number of exterior elements that still convey the feeling of this as being having been a dormitory. The materials inside, there'd be very few contributing elements. In the bed, in the dorm rooms, those little sink, those little wardrobes, the sinks, the little light fixtures, things like that, those are contributing, a lot of those are contributing elements that they haven't been too tweaked. Here they've been pretty tweaked.
It's also important to remember that.
Yeah, originally, the wash bowls and.
Those were original, yes.
And the little cup, closet.
Depending on which dorm you're in.
Oh.
Yeah, if you're in the hotel, a lot of those wardrobes, they're white. And they're built and served in the wall. Those are largely original. What Christopher's done, which is absolutely fantastic for the village, is that they have remodeled a lot of these dormitories, but they've kept some of those historic features, like those sinks and wardrobes and things, and they've retained them, fixed them up, and put them back in place where they were originally.
How much of this work was done by contractors?
Not much.
Oh, not much.
You mean the original?
One person answer, please.
Do you mean the original construction, or do you mean changes?
Yes, all these things,
I think it's fair to say that almost everything that's been done at Holden has been done with volunteers, with very few exceptions over the last 40 years. And a lot of those volunteers might be electrical contractors from Spokane who come up for a month to do some work, but they're here as volunteers.
The other thing to remember is that this building right now has a lot of 1960s feel to it. So there's going to come a point when the 1960s is historic, period.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though something is eligible for the period, you have to look at what period it's eligible for, it's significant for. That will change, that can change over time. So some buildings that have additions or that have been remodeled in the 60s, you know, 50 years from then, you know, from that point, those buildings may be eligible, may be significant.
One other thing to think about is that the town site, what we know as Holden Village, is eligible for the register as a historic district. And generally, a district, I don't want to say the standards are lower for being pristine, but you look at the district as a whole and you try to get a sense, does this still reflect what a mining town would have looked like in the 30s? And there may be some things that aren't, you know, quite exactly the way they were when the place was built, but if the collective place reflects that early history, then the integrity is assumed to be intact. And so it's a balancing act. You know, if you change too many things, then you tip the balance and it's no longer got that integrity. So it's a matter of trying to accommodate change, but still retain as much integrity as you can.
What's the significance of the stone circle?
This was a fireplace. We're in the fireside room. And when Holden was first taken over by the church in the, that sounds horrible, doesn't it? Sort of like the war in Iraq, taken over by the church. They had an architect who came in and tried to carve out some program space where they could do meetings like this, and thought it'd be nice for everybody to sit around the fire. So built the fireplace and then put, you can see the chimney up here, there was a huge metal hood that hovered about right here, like a big black flying saucer. And the only problem was that if you sat in these chairs and the speaker was over there, all you saw was from the knees down. So I suppose about 15 years ago that
happened. They never grew properly either. Every time they started a fire, it set off the fire alarms.
It's also a great place to put your feet.
It is.
Well, I think it would be fair to say that, as Poe has said, that maybe a handful of years, this space will be considered to be itself historically significant, because it tells us about the 60s, or that era when the church came and acquired the property and began to install its own kind of character and values and uses of the property. And then itself can gain significance over time.
You know, at Holden, you're actually sort of blessed with some really good examples of all the criteria that John talked about significant people in local history with the mining and whatnot. You've got architecturally significant buildings. You've got archaeological sites. The town site of Winston, which people call the Miners' Village, and Honeymoon Heights are now pretty much archaeological sites. Those buildings are gone, by and large gone. You see foundations and little steps going up and stuff. Those are archaeological sites that contain, potentially contain, archaeological artifacts that can tell a person like myself and all of us a great deal about the people who lived in those homes and what they did and what their economic status was and who they were. So those are significant for the for D, which was the information potential.
It's too bad they didn't leave one of them or two of them yet.
So even though at Winston, which is a really good example, the buildings are gone, but when you go up there and you walk through that old town site, you do still get a feeling that there was something here. There was a town here that was important in local and state history. So the building doesn't have to be standing to convey that significance. It's an archaeological site at this point. So.
Any other questions or comments? Well, if you go now, you can get in line early for coffee break. Thank you very much.